Welcome back to Bootleg Avocado, bringing you stories in the food startup world. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for joining us for another episode. Anthony, how you doing?
I'm doing very well. Sunny, cold, weird New York.
Well, it snowed, and then it rained, and then the sun's out.
Right, so I think tomorrow I have like a tornado or something?
Maybe, or nor'easter maybe?
Right.
We'll see.
Exactly.
So, this episode, we're going to jump into healthy food brands, especially one called Honey Flower Foods. We have founder Nick Bash with us. Nick, how you doing?
I'm doing great. Very excited to be here.
Yeah.
First podcast in New York City, so you guys check that box.
Yeah, that's good.
There you go.
We try and attract some, you know, new emerging talent, and like all the networking that we both do, like we love to kind of talk to these entrepreneurs and see what they're doing and how they kind of came up with all this, you know, like people are jumping into so many different verticals and niches that it's very unique.
Yeah.
So it's unique to kind of see that and kind of have that. So Nick, give us your, 30-second spiel on Honey Flower Foods.
Yep. So we're a new healthy food company making scalably sustainable and great tasting meals and food products, really mostly targeted towards the grab and go space. It's a big market. It's about $80 billion in the US.
Nice.
And it's really kind of, I guess antiquated to some extent, right? You've got companies like Pret or Starbucks that are looking at the all-day dining and the grab-and-go space and kind of reevaluating their positioning on it, moving towards a larger meal, moving towards some larger pricing. And that's kind of where we've started. Although our meals were designed for the initially kind of for the catering space, we adapted them, adjusted them, and are now in the grab-and-go space. And it's working. So we're kind of following the dollars. We've got over 60 wholesale counts in D.C., we're launching New York this next week, probably.
Is that where you guys started?
Yeah. Nice. So we launched last year, January.
Yeah.
So about a year old.
Congrats.
Yeah, it's cool. We're hustling. That's the bottom line. I think we're working hard. I think we got a great team. Mm-hmm. We're trying to listen a lot. We're learning our way through this space. It's kind of new and odd to some extent. There's about four companies in the U.S. that are doing it. We're one of them. I think that creates an exciting environment.
Mm. That's great. I know the competition is pretty fierce just in those type of spaces, and kind of standing out is the hardest part, especially in New York City. I mean, you're looking at D.C. D.C., it's a little bit more of a sprawling type of city, but, it's tough, kind of getting traction. So how do you start that in D.C., and what were kind of the initial, little bumps in the road that you had to endure?
Yeah, definitely. And to your point, there's no doubt we're getting hit with a lot of, you're gonna have a tough time in New York City. DC's cute and all, but welcome to the big leagues. No, it's great. I mean, I think, actually, DC's been lucky enough that it is an interesting market. And that actually was part of what happened. I had trained and worked in San Francisco for about 5 years, then was in London for three. All the time kind of working and consulting or helping food companies and brands with their products and operations, things like that, and restaurants and all that. I was back in DC where I grew up, kind of ran some quick numbers, did a little bit of quick testing and said, actually it's an interesting dynamic here. There's a strong, compelling city market that we can look at. And I can live in my mom's house. So, let's do it.
Talked about that last episode, living in your parents' house. Like it's one of the best things.
I mean,
it's weird.
It's also about, just sacrificing as you start, you're not going to be in a penthouse.
It's cash.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
Back into your business and you don't have to worry about,
it's a huge deal. I mean, I think for us, we wouldn't be where we are if we weren't able to do that. And we were lucky in some ways that I could melt credit cards to get it going, but that's unsustainable.
Why?
And it put us in a position where we could really fight to try and have some profitability or show some metrics that were strong. And I think all of that stuff made us a stronger company, right? Pushing every day for that extra dollar and just being, I took a very kitchen efficient approach to the business. And I think that's helped us. So my poor mom has to step over boxes to get to her car in the garage.
Dating life has taken
a, oh yeah, you can't, can't have
a bit of a hit.
I always say, you can't have friends over. It doesn't work. Very difficult. You want to come over? No, let's get a hotel or something.
Or your mom comes on and sees the tie.
Yeah. no, you can't. Yeah,
yes,
right.
I can sigh on the door. Yeah, sigh on the doorknob.
I wish I had.
What does
that.
This mean? I'm going into my house.
I wish I had that kind of gall, right? To go, like, hey, Mom, you got to go someplace else tonight. I'm coming during the house. No. So it's hugely, hugely helpful. You know, and I think it's not by accident that you just need every. It's so hard. I mean, I was telling somebody the other day that it is just so hard to start a business, period. Right. And unfortunately, like, that's the reality of the country and the dynamic we're in. Right. Like, you know, you have to take the wins where you can get them.
Right.
And then not to mention, we're in the food space.
Mm.
Everything is. Can I say fucked? Like, it is. Yeah, like, totally fucked. Right. Like, you've got margins against you. You've got labor against you. You've got retail. I mean, that was part of the impetus for getting this going was that. The restaurant model, as beautiful as it is entirely broken. If you have to subsidize based on food costs or alcohol, the model's broken, and then you're not paying people entirely what it is. So, like, we took a lot of that stuff, things that I'd learned and saw, and said, okay, how can we build from the ground up a scalable model that we think works, and then bake in the prices? If people want a great tasting meal that is accessible and convenient, then I'm sorry, you're going to have to pay a little bit for it. I mean, we want to eventually get low and below cost meals to, like, grow the community side of this and make sure. And that's a huge part of our philosophy. But the top line is that, you know, people are so used to not paying what they should for food. And, you know, this is French Revolution stuff, right?
Yeah.
Like, government's interested in keeping that way anyway. So, not to get off on it, but I think, you know, that,
the quality
that factor.
Of the food, the quality of the food is not. They're paying for food that, you know,
you
go into, like, you know, my parents, I mean, like, you know, I grew up in New York, and it's like, you walk into a ShopRite and just buy, like, look at this chicken.
Totally.
It's on sale. You don't know what the hell it is.
Totally. White wheat.
Where it came from. You know, that's just, you know, a lot of people live that way.
Totally. And that's the problem. That's like, and I'm glad you said it, because, like, that is so much a core part. So there's four components to why we started the company. First was healthy food. We wanted to do that. Like, the idea of the most exciting dish in the city wasn't what I wanted to go after. It was more like, let's get food that people don't have to eat every day, but would feel good about eating.
Right.
You know, most of the time or some of the time. Second thing was about scalably sustainable. And this is to that point that, like, if we can't eat or grow it for the next 100+ years, then we don't use it. That means less water, less land. And those two really dictate the menu. What's important about that is that, yeah, we want the soba noodle, the buckwheat, or the brassicas, or the nettles to be cheap and ubiquitous, so much so that they are on the grocery shelf at the gas station instead of the white wheat or the dairy or the sugar products that just, you know, and they have a stranglehold on the industry. We've got a great industrial system.
Right.
I think we need to think about shifting. And there's all kinds of implications to that, right? Like, they're efficient growers. They don't need as much insecticide or pesticide. They're also actually healthier. Like,
right.
I can't wait to come up with that number that's like, having two of our dishes or dishes like them or cooking like this at home has X number of dollar impact on the healthcare system.
Right.
So,
right.
So those are two of them. The third one was zero waste. We start with that from the beginning. We have about 1% right now.
Mm.
And that's like our cauliflower greens.
Yeah.
And that will turn into a kimchi. We got to get the labor and the product cycle to do that.
That's great.
So we're still starting there. And then last one, like I mentioned, is about building a community around this. So getting people excited, getting them to start to think about how they can change the way they eat. There's a bit of it's a good contextual phrase I like to say. It's not entirely accurate, it's 90%, but you could go 80-20. So if 80% of your calories came from plants and the other 20 were from animal products, you could take your car, turn it on, leave it on for the rest of your life, and you'd be net carbon positive.
Wow.
The idea being that, like, the single most important thing you can do, the best impacting thing, is change the way you eat, right? Like, think about your air conditioning, think about your lights, definitely all that. But you switch away from animal-based calories, and you've done, you know, it's all about net wins. People are too busy. You can't, and we don't ask people to go vegan.
Right.
Just 80, go 80-20.
Yeah.
Start to think about that.
Have
so,
a balance of, you know, really abstaining from some proteins that you really don't need.
Exactly.
That's reasonable. And it's, I think it's reasonable to ask people to do that 80-20. I mean,
It's more accessible now than it's ever been.
That's right. And it's healthier. And there's so many reasons. Yeah.
It's going to be interesting. You know, I think it makes people a little more creative in terms of what they can cook with. Vegetables now are so many, you know, there's so many things you can. Like, last night I had, like, sweet potatoes, cauliflower, and I made a sauce for it. It was just like a total. Oh, and I did a farro.
Yeah.
And it was just, like, you know, a completely wholesome meal that I didn't miss, like, having, like, any kind of protein with it.
Yeah.
It was great. Felt good.
It's amazing. I mean, I love this. Our dishes come from all over. I mean, they're amalgamations of, you know, some contextual dishes, I guess. But a couple of things that I do look at are, like, you know, it has to it has to fit into that very kind of specific box from our requirement side.
Yeah.
But then to your point is like, I love dishes that have combinations or influences from very basic styles of eating, right? Like it's not by accident that in very impoverished places, like they stick with some very key and core components in their dishes that they have access to that like nourish your body in a great way. And like, that's kind of how we have to start thinking, right? Is that like people in sub-Saharan Africa you cannot live off of white wheat alone, mm-hmm. right? Despite what the industry will have to tell you in the US, like you cannot do that, right? And so they know that. And so they incorporate other things, sweet potatoes, whatever it is, right, into their diet. And so I think that's kind of at the foundation of what we're trying to do a little bit. There's dishes like, I mean, one of my favorites, like a Nepalese dish. One of the basic Nepalese dishes is nettles and buckwheat. Mm. I mean, you want to talk about superfoods? Like those two and the combination of those two kick the shit out of almost any other dish on the planet.
Right.
And they're eating it in Nepal as like poverty food. Mm.
Right. And also spices too. Yeah. Spices are such a huge part of cuisine around the world.
Totally.
And I think that's another big part here in the United States as well. Like where spices are just like a couple of boxes of McCormick that's like garlic powder that's like in your in your cupboard for like 3 years and you're still using it. But the abundance of spices, fresh spices, that can enhance vegetables and give them that flavor that meat and other things always have. It's always really I love doing that as well.
Totally.
And that's a big part of African cooking.
Totally.
And going on and on.
And it's great. It's a nutritional thing, right? I mean you look at any of the companies that are pushing superfoods or foods for health oriented reasons, or even the companies that we disagree with somewhat, but for like beauty or aesthetic thing, mm-hmm. they're all very important core spices or, turmerics or collagens or things are very fundamental, important components that just got totally, partly out of need. I'm not trashing what we've done in the US necessarily. I mean, I haven't been around long enough to do that, but like, I think we've got to kind of shift back a little bit. So we went a little too far in the wrong direction and we developed incredible flavors. Mm-hmm. But the addictive side of foods and like there's kind of a negative side of that if we start to shift back to more core components, stuff that's a little bit more health focused, has from our side more of a sustainable context, I think, we would be thrilled. And if we can inspire the companies, some of the best things that happen, people taste us at a tasting, we might come back a month later and be like, oh, we tried it and we went home and made it. And I'm like, yes, so give them a high five. I'm like, that's the point, right? Like, I don't want people to eat our dishes every day, mm-hmm. Twice a month, maybe. We're like, we'll build a totally fine business growing the way we're growing. And that's great. We can get into other stuff down the road, frozen foods or CPGs, and, hopefully farther down the line, invest in seaweed farms or nettle fried stuff like that. That to me would be spectacular. And we could call ourselves a success in that mm-hmm. regard. Mm-hmm. But if we're inspiring people to even just think about eating this way, that's a huge win for everybody, So that's why we're doing what we do.
So jumping into kind of the menu development on site. So what are the different kinds of meals that you guys are offering right now? And how did you come up with that whole process of saying, okay, this is going to be our three staples or four staples?
Yep. So pretty much it had to taste good. They had to kind of, they had to be relevant enough that people wouldn't be afraid to try them. I think that was important. And so as you can see, these are complex dishes. If mm-hmm. people go to the website, honeyflowerfoods.com, or if you check out, you've got some images on Instagram, you'll see that we've got three core dishes here, and then we've added a new one. So you've got the soba noodle salad, roasted mushrooms, our potato cauliflower curry, our twice-baked eggplant, and then the new one is called the Vare, for Eric Robert. It's a green bean salad. Mm-hmm. Comes with a whole wheat facility. So these aren't by accident, right? I mean, like, I joke that we may become a pasta company, and that people really like, they respond to that well. It sits on the shelf well. And I'm kind of agnostic to some extent. Like if we can get people to eat all these other vegetables, they're so healthy within the context of a pasta salad, then great. Right. I mean, it's not so bad. So the dishes themselves were, they had to satisfy all those requirements. So nut-free, dairy-free, soy-free, no added sugars, have to come from scalable, sustainable ingredients. And then had some kind of combination of health factors that we thought were good. So we try and use a wide range of ingredients. So they were 40 plus ingredients. We'd adjust that a little bit. They might be 35 or so for each, but a good complex dish that your body chews on for a while. We don't talk about how people feel good after they eat them, kind of by design. We're curious about what they say. Yeah. A lot of the feedback is like, oh, I crushed that dish and I felt great. Mm-hmm. Like,
right. You don't have that weight or that like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's hopefully, again, like we're not nutritionists and we're not food scientists. We're just we're responding to our customers, we're paying attention, we're listening, we say, okay, like, does this make sense? So that's kind of what happened. I'll be honest, I took dishes that I really enjoy or variations of those and said, I think these might do well. And we sample them out. There's probably, another 5 dishes or so that we could add. I mean, I think given the complexity, from a business side, we want to stay very simple. We want to stay streamlined. That helps us grow. It's also a customer expectation thing. They know what they're getting. So that's kind of the framework through which how we design the dishes.
You remember what the first dish was when you first what it was when you created it?
Yeah, different from what it is now.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so it's a soba for sure. And I did some sampling roughly with a couple of different variations of these dishes. The soba was kind of most popular out the gate, so I did that one. And it's funny, it hasn't varied that much necessarily. I think all the same key components are in there. Mm-hmm. What I will say is we've got a couple of fish add-ons that we use as instead of a land-based animal couch, we feel like you have to have it.
Yeah. I love that you have mackerel.
Yeah, so we've got some sustainable
mackerel. Awesome.
Yeah, flavor's good. I mean,
underutilized too. Like a lot of people don't use mackerel.
Well, that's the thing. And for us foodies, people in the food industry, like we get it, we understand it. Fine. There's a lot of people out there, middle America, like it's quite oily as a fish. You have to be careful where you source it from. Mm-hmm. Pacific mackerel is far away different.
You got to break it down a certain way too, because you could like really waste it.
Exactly. Right. And so like our goal was like, does this grow in some kind of sustainable context? So can it be farmed in a way that makes sense? Doesn't put out a lot of waste, is efficient as a grower, right? So like for one input, say, 100 calories of input or whatever, it puts out 400 or 500 calories of output, right? Mm-hmm. Salmon, as amazing as it is, with taste, whatever, is like a 1-to-1 at best. And that's just not the right kind of medium to be growing, right? So I think oysters are the ones we want to add. Sardines are the ones, right? We can get smoked products there. Like, thing is, try selling people on that stuff. They're like, maybe in New York, they'll be like, oh, this is novelty and interesting. But like most people are like, what? That's aggressive.
They're definitely not going to order sardines. They're definitely not going to order like oysters. And, when I do a lot of private events for very wealthy people, a lot of them will be like, whoa, I don't do oysters.
Totally.
I don't do sardines or I don't do anchovies. Yeah. And these are all high quality things that, if they just gave it a shot.
Yep. Exactly.
At least give it a try. A lot of people are very apprehensive about trying things that they're not familiar with. They wouldn't even give it a shot.
And that's a huge part of what our challenge is, to some extent, right? Like these are not, we thought down the road we'd design a shelf dish, right? And so we followed the dollars. Like they sold in cafes. And so we followed the people calling us, hey, we need more and yada, yada. So that's how we ended up here. But I really didn't think these would sell off the shelf. This is not ham sandwich. Right. This is like, you look at this, you're like, what the hell is going on here? I don't know. And at the price point, so 12, 14 bucks, people really got to commit, they got to be like, so to your point, like, from a product company, 2 things. One, it's our responsibility to like expose people to this type of stuff, make great products so they share the knowledge or participate in it. And then also, understanding what the customer wants and needs and trying to match that and push them a little bit,
right,
to say, hey, like, what about this or whatever? So sampling is a huge component of what we're doing to try and overcome.
Perfect example. We went for lunch the other day.
Don't remind me. That was the worst lunch I've had in like.
That, it was pretty.
Oh my god.
Nasty. Now, granted, I got beets. I got pickled red onions.
Great,
I did some rye. Like I really like. It was a vegetable bowl.
Yeah.
But it was just. It was like. I don't know what the hell. I think it was like almost like somebody just shoveled out of like a compost bin and just put it into like
Jesus.
A bowl. It was just terrible. Yeah. And it wasn't cheap.
Yeah.
And if we could get something like this, like we would have gone for it in a minute.
Yeah.
Because I guess we're chefs, so we're looking at it, but we wanted to find something that was going to be a little more nourishing, has some good flavor to it.
Totally.
And it's not easy to find, even being in the middle of New York City.
Totally. And I think that's exactly it. It's like fast casual is important. I mean, people under the context of the business side, right? Like how do we grow? What's our differentiator? I mean, we're learning through a fire hose about what we need to do as a business to grow up.
Yeah.
And the food space is funny, right? Because like there's all these different, when I talk to food people and I talk about our food costs or our labor costs or the efficiencies we're finding, that's all very exciting. They get it. But everybody else is like, well, yeah, but Sweetgreen could do this.
Right.
What are you going to do? And I'm like, that's ridiculous. Like, first of all, the space is huge. No one eats the same thing every day, yada, yada, yada. But also, like, our differentiator is in a lot of ways our product, right? Like, and so that's probably why it's so frustrating. And it is. Everyone has that experience. You go out, You go someplace, it checks the box for convenient, checks the box for casual, you're in and out, whatever. And then you dive into it. I had this experience yesterday.
Yeah.
Tried a new place. I've heard some people, but a couple of feedback was like, well, you know, it's all right. Okay, cool. I'm going to try it. I mean, same deal. Lovely, well-portioned set of vegetables that I was just like, again, our eye will be a little bit more critical, but I was just like, bummer. Like, that's too bad. Because had they done these two or three things, this dish would have been great.
Yeah,
and right. It would have been totally satisfying, mm-hmm. vegetable-based. So, yeah, the product is super important. I think that's where we, you know, I know it's funny. I don't think of myself as a product person to say, but I've been doing products for a long time.
Right.
So
yeah.
Like,
I mean, the product is.
People say, I know, it's like, it's
really
like
from that perspective now.
Yeah, exactly. And so, but it's funny as we test and we constantly improve and try and make them better that like, you know, that the more we focus and are careful there, the better we are as a business, I think. And that is, that will be our differentiator, I think. So. Yeah.
Cool. So, Nick, let's take a quick break. I'm going to come back. We're going to jump into the empathy question of the day, which is a great, interesting thing. Okay. We'll be right back, guys. Welcome back to Bootleg Avocado, bringing you stories in the food startup world. So it's that time of the episode in which we can do the empathy question. We have founder of Honey Flower Foods, Nick Bash, with us today. So, Nick, since you're here, which is a great, great thing. You get to pick one of these cards.
Amazing.
And
love
then that's it to you. And then I'll read the question. I mean, how do you build endurance? And be as honest and as personal as you.
What an appropriate question.
Yeah.
This is amazing.
Yeah.
Today's been full of moments like this, which is awesome. And,
yeah.
I think actually that's how I would answer the question, is that by listening and paying attention, which mm-hmm. is, you know, I know it's odd for someone who cooks. I don't have any tattoos, but if I did, I'd get, you know, fais attention or pay attention. Why in French? Because I took French as a child and
you
the teacher,
remember it.
Well, because the teacher would always say, fais attention, Nicolas, because I wouldn't pay attention. I was always doing something.
Right.
And the bottom line is, like, yeah, if you pay attention to things, stuff comes up. And what ended up happening is there was a synergy of like, I cannot explain to you the number of things that came together for this business to happen the way it did.
Yeah.
And it was partially from me paying attention or seeing those things or whatever, you know, and, you know, perfect example. There's a lot of stuff that's out of our control, but when you see it through the lens or the context of whatever it is that you're doing, there's incredible power and strength that can come from that.
Mm.
And so it was that alignment of seeing what was happening, coming together, getting really excited about it, and knowing that there would be an incredible amount of energy that would have to happen to make that happen. And that all came together and has led to me producing and being more effective over a long period of time mm-hmm. than I probably ever could have imagined. And so in that, I think through that, it's created endurance. But we're at a very interesting moment right now,
right.
a year on, where like we are spread incredibly thin between growing in DC, being here in New York, thinking about launching a market. And like, you know, it's easy, I think, to get into that trap of like more, go, 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 go. And, you know, I think there's a balance that has to be had there. And so we're definitely, this happened and it's not totally, new. This happens every 3 months or so, given the way we're growing, that like, we'll get to a point where I recognize in myself that I don't mind, you know, working really hard in this period, which I think needs to happen to get the business off the ground,
right.
but it's certainly not sustainable for the 20-year, 30-year, right? And I
right,
get
right,
that.
Right.
But even in the short term, when I realize like I'm at my end or some of the little things, again, paying attention that like, oh, we missed, you know, I didn't hit this follow-up email or some things that start to be core are not hitting.
Yeah.
We take a stop. Wait a second. Well, it's not, we got to reevaluate the scenario. We got to bring people in. We got to solve the problem so that we can get back to a position that is at least more sustainable, more endurance building for the next 6 months or so to get us to that, whatever that next milestone is.
Yeah.
And so that's a perfect, I mean, this week and last week, this weekend I got back, it was my birthday on Monday.
Oh,
ridiculous.
Nice.
I probably had one of the craziest
days. It was,
days.
Or it is?
It was.
It was
past
okay.
Monday.
Happy birthday.
Thank you. And one of the craziest days ever. I mean, it was a moment where like Jamie, my brother and I sat down the other day and said, everything is broken. We've successfully broken everything.
So, you didn't get to enjoy your birthday.
Not at all. It was one of those birthdays. I told my mom this because she wanted to, you know, do nice stuff. I said, this is one of those days where like, I really wish you could choose the day because like, I just don't need this today. Like,
you know, people are calling me and texting me doing all this stuff, and I feel really terrible because I'm like, this, you know, it's really nice, it's amazing, but like I'm putting out so many fires in so many different areas. I was like, it was a nuisance. It was honestly annoying. Like, and that gets back to it, right? Like, you don't want a day like that. It shouldn't be that way. And you know, so we hit that point. We both sat down. We're both just like, you know, and I think acknowledging that, owning it, and then saying, okay, we pick ourselves up. What are the next 5 things we got to do?
Right.
Check the boxes, move forward. You know, part of it's perspective that like there's always good, right? And none of the major errors when we say it's broken, like these are relatively minor breaks, but a lot of them all at once, you know, that can be quite painful.
Right.
But that, you know, they're fixable and we can do this. So, okay, what do we do? And now this week's back on track and we're gearing up, and you know, it's very much that, I think there's a lot to be learned. Again, I'm not a business person, but I so much love the education I got in kitchens, because the sense of urgency, the effectiveness, the efficiency, all those things, I think lead to good business practices. Right. And, you know, it's very much that crescendoing effect, you know, like running a kitchen, somewhat like an orchestra or something. Everything has to happen in time. Like, when you know certain things are at a time, they have that compounding effect where, you know, 3 hours from now, you're going to be in the weeds because this fucking thing didn't happen on time or so-and-so, right? So you try and build the redundancies, but you know that's going to happen. And then finally, maybe you reach that moment, you speed up, you catch up, maybe you catch it, maybe you don't. But then, you know very clearly when you're back on track. And so that was kind of the scenario we had this week. And just very interesting parallels that we've seen between them. So anyway, very long-winded answer. But
no, that's a great
But, you know, just kind of building upon what you're saying too, it's like, I think the one thing they don't teach us in kitchens, though, is how to respond to something in a analytical good way. It's like, if you was fucked up, like you're getting yelled at, or your chef, you know, your chef is yelling at somebody, or yelling. You know, there's a lot of yelling. There's a lot of anger. There's a lot of blaming.
Totally.
Whereas in this business world, or in the business you're in, you know, that's not going to work.
Totally.
You got to stop. You got to say, wait, what part did I play in this?
Yep.
What caused this? Let's take a minute. Let's be patient. Let's analyze the situation. And I think for me, as a business person as well, I learned that because, you know, for years of being in a kitchen, it's like, try not to make a mistake. And then if you do make a mistake, it's like, you know, all out war. And it's crazy. But now it's like, wait a second. You know what? That was really, why am I getting mad at somebody else? I mean, that's really my mistake. Or, you know, and that's really what chefs are, you know, the reason chefs yell at somebody else is because of their lack of preparation for what's happening.
Totally. Or the internal angst that is caused. Like, I think, and this is what happens with, and this, I mean, this is amazing that you guys do this empathy question or some mental health component.
Yeah,
because that is very much why another big part, getting back to the broken system, is that like something like 70 million Americans have worked in a kitchen at one point or another. They are incredibly, for the most part, and this is changing, like really terrible high stress environments that have not been, you know, OSHA, fine, whatever, but they're not really looking at best practices in kitchens. And you've got, you know, the drug abuse or the, you know, now we're seeing, I mean, the Anthony Bourdain thing, right? That's that on so many levels hits people in so many ways, but it totally points out that like there's a massive under researched, underappreciated psychological problem in an environment that like no structure in the world from a business would ever design it the way a kitchen is. And some of that is designed by the way the structure of ordering is and all that stuff. But some of it's also the management, right? And then if that continues, then you get this where like, I mean, you become a different person. And you know, it's like anything, when you're super high stressed and you boil over, well, yeah, that outlet naturally is going to happen. And if you're on that level all the time, you know, there's no, it becomes very difficult for people to have the mindfulness, the awareness to say, oh, wait, right? And then you have,
It's like Vietnam, you know, like you go into Vietnam, either you came out two different ways. Like you came out like the guy who gets flashbacks and goes crazy, or you're like, you know, I was in Vietnam, I handled it, I took care of it, and I'm kind of like making it through and I've kind of realized my situation.
Right.
But the world of the food world, at one point, and I think it's changed a lot because nowadays you can't. There's a lot of things you can't do now.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, like your whole staff will quit on you if you like go crazy.
Yeah,
you know, and the world of Gordon Ramsay and Michelin star. Maybe I'm the Michelin star, but maybe not even that anymore. I mean, I think now everyone's trying to be. They know that efficiency and good work ethic and good food comes from a Zen environment, or at least a team environment where everyone trusts each other and there's communication.
Yep.
As opposed to when I was like, you know, getting salt thrown at my face, or like getting yelled at or embarrassed, or,
yeah,
you know, things thrown at me.
Yeah. I mean, we're all
doing
that.
Just
in culinary school?
And that was just the first day. That was,
yeah. No, it's crazy.
Getting
it's
kicked off the line, you know, and yeah, going home and just like, you know, feeling like crap.
Yeah. I think it's so true. I think that's, again, my experience is limited. I don't have decades of experience. So I don't know what 20 years ago was, but I remember the first kitchens I worked in were very different to the last, uh-huh, later kitchens.
You work in D.C. or was it?
So I started a couple places in D.C., just kind of rough, off the edges, doesn't matter. I mm-hmm. won't mention because they were some of those types of kitchens,
yeah,
which is a bummer. And then made my way to San Francisco, and that was where I did more fine dining, which was mm-hmm. great. But even there, I mean, still a very kind of masochistic approach to food. And there's
yeah.
a little bit of the old guard in that. And
oh,
part
yeah.
of it I wanted to see that discipline. I wanted to understand strong practice. But,
right.
you know, it's like anything, you know, where, and we struggle with this. Like, we're building an organization. We're building a team. I want, you know, how do you match? I was telling somebody, so that, how do you match high performance and incredible consistency and quality and intention, which tends to come with an intensity, potentially,
yeah, absolutely,
with an environment that is conducive to acceptance and openness and balance, right? We're like, you know, it's really hard, right? Like, I got a guy, very smart guy, once told me that, like, flexibility is the key to operational success.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, how flexible are menus? How flexible is food storage? How flexible is the prep list, right? Like,
how flexible is your
customer?
Yeah, right.
Or
how flexible is the
customer? Or your bottom line.
Yeah.
You know, like, you could, you know, somebody makes a mistake. I think, you know, too, like, for me, it was like, there's always, like, even with my own son, whatever mistake he makes, drops something on the television or breaks my laptop or whatever the case may be, my response is always going to be, you know, I love my son regardless. He made a mistake and I'll figure it out.
Right.
I'm not going to hurt my son in any way because of something that he did. Now, take that to a kitchen where you say, this cook just destroyed this whole table with something he did. Now, either I'm going to lash out at that person, or we're just going to like roll it back a little bit, take a minute and just rework
yeah.
ourselves
yeah.
and get it done.
Right. And hopefully that's the future, right? I mean, hopefully that is how things develop. I think by design, we create open areas and time for that, right? By having a simple menu, by taking the pressure of service out of it,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
We can create a far more open environment and still be quite effective. And that's my approach on the production side. Mm-hmm. So we've got a great kitchen environment. And I want people that love coming to work, and we create a great environment, and it's fun. You get to do the cooking, you have a great team, and you know, we're working on that. We have our days, fine, but you know, they're, at the end of the day, we're always sure that like everyone felt valued there, that they all felt good, right? No one leaves, and you know, and I think everybody really appreciates that, because you know, hopefully that's where stuff moves. And but yeah, that's a challenge, right? Like, how do you do both of those, especially given the context of our training, our exposure, what we've seen, or like you said, the pressure of, you know, the customer or reviews, right? Like, you know, we put out one bad dish. I don't know what happens.
We get someone sick.
I don't know what happened. You know, it doesn't matter that we did 25,000 dishes
yeah.
for that
yeah.
6 months or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, hopefully more than that, but like, that doesn't matter.
It's very current, you know, it's very now in terms of food. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like, what are you doing now with this? And if it's not good, it's just,
yeah,
it's just not good.
Yeah. So I think, so that's empathy.
Yeah.
We need more of it.
Yeah, exactly.
We need more of it.
So let's switch up real quick. So let's talk about kind of your expansion plan and, you know, where you want Honey Flower Foods to kind of go. You mentioned New York City that you're kind
yep.
of testing it. What's kind of the goal?
Yeah, kind of big. The next benchmarks will be testing a new city, continue to improve our existing market in DC, and understanding that, like I said, learning a lot about
yeah.
the space we're in and what
yeah.
customers want and
yeah.
the product fit. And then it's really testing the model of launching open new cities. But you know, if the goal is to be a great product company that is hopefully stands for something good around sustainability
mm-hmm.
in the food system,
mm-hmm.
You know, then the goal is we got to kind of grow and hopefully grow quickly. So yeah, test a new city, test that market, how we can kind of enter it, see what happens,
yeah.
along with kind of hopefully raising some money or thinking about that. And then, you know, I think like I said earlier, like we want to take a very practical business approach to this. Mm-hmm. I think if we continue to do so, that will help us avoid a lot of the pitfalls that companies in the foods, you know, they try and grow too fast, or,
right.
you know, because, you know, adoption is just not the same as it is in tech. So, right. you know, you have to factor that. So I think the combination of those two things will hopefully lead to multiple cities, get national, mm-hmm. grow a brand that people are excited about, and then continue to grow into other verticals. So, you know, there's very easy for us to get into frozen foods, very easy for us to get into snacks or CPGs. You know, mm-hmm. we look at companies, like I said, like Patagonia, for lack of a better example, or Dr. Bronner's, right, where you stand for good. You've got, you know, a range of products that people can enjoy at various moments or throughout their life. And honestly, you know, like from our side, you know, the more that we can do, hopefully the more fun we can have on the sustainability end, you know, really thinking about, yeah, the seaweed farms or nettle farms or working with partners to think about vertical growing, right? I mean, like, that is going to be such an exciting space mm-hmm. over the next decade as we learn about how we can feed people, you know, in a more effective, efficient way, mm-hmm. you know, locally or globally, really. And so that's kind of, those are like, that's the longer
yeah.
general plan.
Are you also targeting tier like 2 and 3 cities like Austin, Texas, or like the smaller ones? You
totally.
Know,
just, yeah.
Because I think you'll stand out
totally.
In those cities that are actually very agriculturally, you know, driven and forward.
Totally.
And,
right.
Yeah.
Totally. I think, yeah. I mean, I think one nice thing about DC and what was interesting about that is that like companies like Starbucks or Chipotle or Pete's, they test.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their top testing cities is DC.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's because it's got a good mix of type of environment.
Yeah.
Like you've got people who are transient that come in for 4 years or 5, right, because of administrations, and then go.
Hopefully.
Or you've got immigration, right? Or you've got exactly. You have you know, international, you've got a smart population, you have a lot of PhDs. And so
yeah.
I think it's a good testing environment for that. So yeah, we get people who travel or like from Denver who are
mm-hmm.
screaming from, I mean, those are the people that get it. Like, you know,
yeah,
like I
definitely.
Said, I'm very West Coast in my approach to food. And so
yeah.
I think we won't have any trouble hitting cities like that. I think
right.
it's more a thought of, we have an opportunity here because we're in a program in New York. And I think it was something we wanted to test the second half of this year anyway,
mm-hmm.
just kind of move that timeline up and great. Well, you know, we should take advantage of the opportunity to be here. We'll learn something either way.
Yeah,
we might get, you know, our asses handed to us and fine, we pick up and we think about it a new way. But absolutely. I mean, I think cities that, you know, may not have access. I mean, again, it's all about access and growing that. So yeah, Denver, Seattle, Dallas,
Atlanta,
Austin. Yeah.
So you started in DC, what was your criteria to say, all right, you know what, we're ready to go into another city?
Yeah. So like I said, it was really mostly that we got into a program up here
mm-hmm.
by kind of luck. And, and that was really the big impetus. Like, look, we're here. I'm here 4 days a week now. You know, under the context of learning how to raise money and thinking about the business in a new way, which has all been amazing, and we're incredibly grateful to be here. And yeah, I think that was kind of it. It was like, okay,
it was like a nice organic flow to get you to the next.
Sort of, yeah. I mean, I think it's definitely also pressure, though. Right? Like, had we had a little more control, but we probably would have thought a bit differently. But you know, at the same time, like, it's created the environment for us to think about. Okay, how do we grow into this, and how do we take advantage of this as an opportunity? And I think from a position perspective, it's important, right? I think doing the combination of, you know, hopefully growing a city and thinking about our economics and showing that we've got a good model, plus being able to launch a new city,
mm-hmm.
put us in a position to say, hey, look, we found something, we think.
Right.
Let's give this a shot.
It's got legs in a city. It's getting, you know, at least that traction.
Yeah. And then I joke that, you know, you guys with your sophisticated palates here in New York, if we get you guys to like it, we won't have a problem with the rest of the city, you know, rest
that,
of the country.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. But New York is tough, you know, because I think New York has a very bold population of both sides. You have very bold foodies. You have people who are interested in food, who recognize food, look for good value. But then you have people that just like McDonald's. They like, you know, their little bodega on the corner. They love it. And that's all they know, even though they're walking past things that can provide, you know, sustainable, great food, or at least trying to.
Yeah.
They just walk by it. And everyone's just sort of like walking by. And I think, as you mentioned before, you know, education, educating the consumer about what they eat is a really big part of it.
Huge. And the habits to that, right?
Like, it's like,
everyone's so busy. You're so checked out. You only have so much mental energy, right? I mean, I think that's why at the end of the day, it's got to be a good product. It has to taste good,
right?
We're not going to sell anybody
right.
on, I mean, as much as they do care, you're not going to buy a bad product because it's sustainable.
I worked for a QSR, you know, we have farm to table, and, you know, one day we're kind of, you know, we're there busting our heads, trying to get all this stuff launched, like going to farms and everything. And we notice our employees are coming back from lunch with McDonald's. And, you know, they can eat as much of this food for free as they like. They're in front of it all day. But, you know, just that habit, you know, even money is not even going to get in the way of that. Like, there, I'm like, you can get a free lunch, it's healthy, but you know what? Forget it. I'm just going to go pay for what's familiar. And, you know, we recognize that that was a huge hurdle, you know, just getting people to try new things or just to even let them know what it is they're eating.
Crazy, isn't it? I literally had this conversation with a chef in D.C. not too long ago. You know, we're chatting about the model and, you know, we're just shooting the breeze. And we both said that. We're both like, it's unbelievable that, like, this is an incredibly high quality restaurant and your staff meal, family meal, is better than 90% of the dishes that will be eaten in the city tonight, and the employees will choose to go to Chipotle or something.
Right.
Yeah.
More often than not. It's like, what, you know, how do you get?
Yeah. I mean, I understand it. You know, it's familiar. Hey, you know, every once in a while, whatever, variety, nice and all that stuff. But it's just, we're so, with food, it's just a habit. Yeah. It's a lot of fear there. Yeah,
totally.
I think there's, you know, there's a lot of fear.
Fatigue, and then, like, you know, Michael Pollan and a lot of what he says, you know, the addictive qualities of the stuff, right? Like,
oh yeah.
You know, sugar, we you know, refined sugar in its purest form, we just don't touch it. I mean, that is the most toxic thing. I mean, and it's just insane that, you know, we'll come to this determination slowly as a culture over the next 20 years, but, like, it is by far and away the single worst thing in the food system, right? Like, and we just got to get rid of it. Everyone just needs to commit and say, we're not going to use refined sugar. You know, yeah, substitute some other things and be gentle with our sugars. And, you know, we have to learn a lot about how to do that. But, oh, man, what, you know, that is like, it is crack for food, and it is terrible. It's really, I mean, it's a killer.
Yeah. Tax it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. You can't, I mean, I lived there for 3 years. I loved it. I mean, they're about to tax animal products. I'm like, this is unbelievable. You know, it's like, and I'm not, you know, I'm not saying this, you know, people give me a hard time for that, but, like, they are being aggressive in certain areas in a really good, smart way. And I think, you know, they're a smaller country. They're, you know, it's probably a little bit somewhat easier for them to do to some extent, but they didn't get the same stranglehold on the industry that are big, you know, the sugars, the dairies, the wheat, corn, soy, they really, you know, they've hammered it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think, you know, and I was having this conversation with someone else as well, you know, not to get political or anything like that, but, you know, there's a lot of immigration issues in this country. There's a lot of immigration issues throughout the world. But I think one of the main concerns, I think, is the food supply. You know, the United States has to feed a lot of people. And eventually, you know, I mean, it's been said that we're not going to be able to produce enough food to feed billions and billions of people on this earth. We have to find other ways to feed people.
Yep.
And the way we're doing it right now, it's not going to cut it.
And that's
exactly going to hit a breaking point.
And that's exactly what this is all about, right? Like, if you replace, crops that you can grow efficiently, like a buckwheat or seeds and nuts, things like those are far more efficient growers. And we can grow them with less, you know, this land-based animal calories are just not the ticket, you know, and not to harp on that point. And, like, we're not out to save the world necessarily. We're just trying to be smart about it and do – really, it's more about doing our part. I felt a responsibility to say, look, we don't know everything, and we're learning. And we're trying to learn fast. But, you know, I felt like we can't not participate in trying to think about this differently. And there's, you know, something like 2 billion people over the next 25 years or something will be born in Africa that will die of starvation. That will be a side effect, somewhat related to poverty, but really more a food crisis. Right. They'll have no choice in the matter, and it's outrageous. We waste 40% of our food in the U.S. You know, it's like, and I know everyone knows these stats. They throw it out, they get upset about it, but, like, when you think about that, you're like, oh wow, how fortunate were we to be born, whatever. Yeah, it's like, we can solve this problem, and we just all have to kind of together say, look, there's certain things we're not going to stand for. And one, we're all in it together. We're a planet. We're a community. And two, like, yeah, this huge separation, we got to fix that. You know, that's a lot of people.
I mean, it's a great approach to food that's always been around us, and you're making it more accessible. So that's a great thing. So Nick, to close off, so how can people get in touch with you?
Yeah, great. So go to the website. It's probably the easiest. We've got a phone number on there. You can call. You know, for New Yorkers right now, we won't deliver. not yet, but please call us anyway. We're happy to chat and learn more. I think, you know, it'd be great to find out what local markets near you guys you want us to be stocked at as we explore this market. Like I said, we're shooting to go at least start soft launching next week, a couple different markets.
Great, okay.
So we'll probably start with like a Balducci, something like that.
Great.
You know, we're investigating a couple other markets and shops, Amish markets, I guess it's gourmet grocery, things like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, we'd love to hear insights about that. And then, you know, as that happens, watch our Instagram and you know, we should kind of release, hey, we're here,
right.
You know, a bit more on like a find us in New York kind of thing. Mm-hmm.
So honeyflowerfoods.com, correct?
Yes, that's
okay.
It. Yep.
Great, Nick. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a lot of fun.
Go to the website, go to Instagram.
Yeah.
So anything real quick, Speak Feast.
So my company is Speak Feast. You can follow me on Instagram or our website. It's also Chef Anthony Nichols on Instagram. Consulting, private events. I do a little bit of everything. I hustle. So reach out.
Cool. And I'm Mario Rodriguez from Bootleg Avocado. We help to scale food startups on the operation and culinary side. So thanks for listening to this episode. We'll be back with another episode, another entrepreneur, another food concept. Thanks again.